I'd like to welcome everyone here today, come to hear this debate. As you inevitably realize, this area of the world that we're talking about has brought mankind on successive occasions to the brink of war in recent history. And if we look at it as a spot throughout history, we note that it's at a continual association of conflict in the area. Technically, the debate is between the Arab side and Israel, and I'd like to just make a few introductory comments about how it got to be that way, as sort of general orientation before we move into formal mechanisms of debate. Israel was born, modern Israel, in 1948, and was a relatively small country, not much bigger than the what they call Big Island in Hawaii, approximately 7,000 square miles. It was a British mandate. The British had taken the area by force during the First World War. Prior to that, the area was under the control successfully from Egypt, the Egyptian Empire, to Israeli tribes who conquered the area, the Persian Empire, the Roman Empire, the Arabs, the Ottoman Empire. And in each of these conquests, there was persistent turmoil, strife, and if one goes back, for example, into Roman records, you see a continual discussion of what they call the Palestine question then. When the British conquered the area in World War I, they got the French and Russians to agree to internationalize the area in the expectation that this might finally bring peace. And so what was Palestine became a British mandate. That meant, in effect, that the British could control the area, but the expectation was that it would eventually become independent. At this time, a British Secretary of State by the name of Balfour promised that the Jewish people would be able to establish a home in this mandated area, but it was not made clear at that time whether they would have an independent state separate from that of the Arab peoples living in the same area. Now, the Arabs, of course, opposed this declaration by Balfour, and almost immediately riots and strife broke out. And the British found themselves in a very uncomfortable situation for several years of attempting to mediate between the two sides. I think on balance, we'd have to say that they were primarily pro-Jewish throughout most of the period. But they were not unsympathetic to the Arab demands. For example, the Legislative Council they proposed for the mandate would have been composed of 14 seats for the Arabs and 8 seats for the Jews, which presumably was some kind of reflection of the actual population balance in the area. After repeated efforts to deal with the strife that developed around the immigration of the Jews into the area, Lord Peel, in 1936, recommended partitioning of the area, that is, a division into Jewish and Arab sectors. The Arabs revolted against the British because of this plan in 1937-38, and a League of Nations became involved with the issue and supported the petition plan. But then, as the British were wont to do, they changed their mind and said partition was not a good idea. In spite of this, the Arabs continued to revolt, and by 1939, things were getting quite serious. For example, in that year, roughly around it, 110 Arabs were hanged, and over or close to 6,000 were held. The White Paper in that year indicated that a more Arab stance would be taken in the future. That is, the British committed themselves to limiting immigration over the next 5 years to 75,000 Jews into the area, and then having no further immigration unless there was Arab agreement. At this point, the Zionists became extremely unhappy and, of course, opposed this plan. Israel, however, interrupted the dialogue. And during the war, the United States began to become a participant in the area in the sense of beginning to think in terms of attempting to alleviate the problem. Truman came out vigorously near the end of the war for an immediate immigration of 100,000 Jews. Throughout this period of debate, near the end of the war and before the Jewish state was created, there was a great deal of illegal immigration that the British attempted to stop. At this point, the United Nations comes into the picture and more or less picks up where the League had left off, adopting a partition plan, which the United States initially supported. The Arabs, however, opposed this plan, and the British, getting sick of the whole thing, decided to end their mandate. That is, they simply walked out. The United States, before this walkout, because of the conflict that immediately developed, because of the proposal for partition, withdrew its support of partition. But after the British walked out, and Israel declared itself to be an independent state, the United States became a supporter of Israel, immediately recognizing Israel, and then pushing vigorously for some kind of UN solution to the fighting that erupted. During this period, Israel expanded significantly her borders. The UN sent in a mediator, Count Bernadotte, who was assassinated by Jewish fanatics. Rob Bunch replaced Bernadotte, and finally by 49 a ceasefire was established. A commission was also created by the UN to help settle differences. And as you well know, the history since then has been a bloody one. Russia now comes vigorously into the picture. The British, the French, retain their strong interests. And these powers start moving into what might be called balance of power policies in this area. That is, attempting to equate the military equipment of both sides, assuming that somehow this would deter rather than encourage conflict. The British and the French, for the most part, are sympathetic to the Jews, at least until recently. And in 1956, they agreed with the Jews against Egypt, in the famous invasion of Egypt in 1956, that the United Nations and the U.S. opposes.
Professor Witten?
Yes.
I wonder whether you should stand where you stand now or in on the other table, because I'm sorry, this presentation was not programmed when this debate was set up, and you are making a totally one-sided presentation on the issue. I would propose that you start the debate, because otherwise you should sit on that
table. Well, I have, of course, a few more sentences to go.
Okay.
All right. The United States and the United Nations opposed this invasion, and the British and the French were forced by world opinion to leave. In 1967, war broke out again, the famous Five-Day War, and Israel substantially enlarged her borders, and this presents the, or at least her area of control, bringing over a million Arabs under Jewish control, and taking areas that were previously Arab, such as the Sinai Peninsula. The present crisis, the 1973 crisis, stems obviously directly from the 1967 crisis, and could be probably viewed as an attempt on the part of the Arabs to redress the situation in their eyes to where it was prior to 1967, or perhaps even prior to that. At the present time, I think we have to say we're in a situation where there is no obvious solution. Both sides have talked in the last few days of the possibility of continuing war in the area. There's considerable pressure by the United States and now Russia to set up some sort of permanent settlement, but obviously a great deal is going to depend upon the attitude of the parties to the contested area, which is relatively enormous, say, compared with the size of Israel itself. Okay, with that opening statement, I'd like to indicate the agreement concerning the nature of this debate. Both sides agree that the Arabs will speak first,
No, we didn't agree.
You didn't agree? Okay, you reversed yourself. That the Israelis will stay first. Israeli side. The opening statement by the Israelis would be 10 minutes, the Arabs would double 10 minutes. The Arabs then had a 10-minute opening statement, and the Israelis will rebut for 10 minutes. After that, there will be a 20-minute free debate. This means either side can speak, but the expectation is that the speech will be limited to approximately 1 minute. After that 20-minute period, the audience will be free to participate in the debate. So with that, I grant the Israeli opening statement.
Before we start the opening statement, I think time should be given to us to complete the one-sided opening statement you made, because you cited some facts and you didn't say you spoke about some facts and you didn't speak about others. For instance, you didn't mention at all World War II and the reason why the UN decided to approve the creation of the State of Israel. You forgot completely to state, when we talked about 1948, you said that Israel extended its borders in the fighting that followed. You didn't say that this fight was started because the Arab nations, the Arab League, seven countries, as a matter of fact, didn't accept the creation of the State of Israel and invaded Israel. So the fight didn't start from the air. The fight started with an attack to a country that had just been born and had no army and nothing. The presentation we made about the fight...
Mr. Rosenthal,
yes.
Let me interrupt. I'm going to subtract this from your 10-minute time. Now, you can either begin with your statement or not.
Because you're
making ridiculous points. My statement was Israel expanded her border. She did expand her border.
Okay.
Now, if you contest that fact, contest it. But don't talk about other things.
Okay.
So did Israel expand her border?
I just want to put it on record that you took time which had not been assigned for you during the setup of the debate.
My statement can be proved to be false. I'll make a public retraction in the paper. Otherwise, continue with your opening statement.
Okay, we'll start now with our opening statement.
Let me introduce at least one side, because I'm not familiar with the other side. This is Mr. Yehia Avisar. I'm Gila Avisar. And to my right is David Rosenthal. And we're all BFA students at Florida Atlantic University. Dr. Vincent, let me just point out one thing. We didn't say that the facts you brought were wrong, but you didn't bring all the facts. And one more important fact that I think should be mentioned is that 6 million Jews were killed in Europe during World War II by Nazi Germany. And this is what created the illegal immigration into Israel. The Jews had nowhere to go. The United States didn't accept the Jewish refugees from Europe. Nobody accepted them. They went with half-broken boats to Israel, and the British didn't let them in. That's just another fact to add to your list of facts. When we talk about the question of peace in the Middle East, and this is the title for our debate today, we should bear in mind one thing. We can talk about the age-old conflict between Israel and the Arab states, and we can talk about the last war that broke out on October 5th. At any rate, and generally speaking, and all along, the only thing that the Arabs claim basically is hatred. And let me simply quote out, starting from 1948, Arab statements along the line of, this is by Hassan Pasha, Secretary General of the Arab League, May 16, 1948. This will be a war about the war of independence. This will be a war of extermination and a momentous massacre which will be spoken of like the Mongolian massacre and the crusade. From 1954, right before the Sinai campaign, this is by Mohammed Salah al-Din, who is the Egyptian Minister for Foreign Affairs. It will only get complete satisfaction when Israel is finally allotted out of the map of the Middle East. From 1969, by Gamal Abdel Nasser, the former Egyptian leader. We want a decisive battle in order to annihilate that germ, Israel. All the Arabs want a decisive battle. So 1967, June 4th, one day before the 1967 war broke out, the Arab struggle must lead to the liquidation of Israel. And this was by President Abu Boumediene of Algeria in one of the major Arab conferences. The decision of the Arab Summit Conference in Khartoum that took place between August and September of 1967, following the 67 war, came out with the following. No peace in Israel, no recognition of Israel, no negotiations with it. 1972, from May. In the coming campaign, and this is by Egyptian President Sadat, in the coming campaign, there's no way out but the complete liquidation of Israel. We shall not negotiate with Israel, whatever the circumstances. So what we're talking about is very simply basic hatred with no reason whatsoever. And the only wish is liquidation, total liquidation. Slaughter the Jews, throw them into the sea. The Jews, the Israelis. Now there is no reason for this hatred and this burning lust to liquidate and wipe out. Jewish history in the land of Israel dates back for over 4,000 years. And if anybody has any doubts, just open the Bible. Just about the second or third chapter. But more than that, maybe the Bible is not accepted as a historical evidence. Archaeology is, and the Israeli period, so-called by archaeology, dates back in Israel 4,000 years back from this day. All the conquerors in this area recognize the special relationship between the Jewish people and the land of Israel. More than that, the Jewish religion is that kind that it kept that link between the Jews all over the world and the state of Israel, and every Jew says on every major holiday next year in Jerusalem. History, and this is by two Arabic historians, teaches us that Arabs became a majority in the land of Israel only in just about the 11th century AD, and this is with the expansion of the Islam in the Arab countries that came from the Arab Peninsula. But when we talk about Palestine, then we talk about people who came only at the 11th century. Now the Zionist movement that came up in Europe didn't create anything new. And I'd like to repeat my words, didn't create anything anew. It only organized and modernized a movement which existed for hundreds of years amongst the Jews, the result of which was immigration to Israel. Now the last war, as far as we can see, is just one more piece in the chain of hatred and repeated trials to liquidate the Jewish state, but that Jewish state by the name of Israel. Now Israel is seeking for peace. Israel was the one who always asked the Arabs to come sit with it, to come negotiate. Israel was the one who was willing to sit almost anywhere as long as these are direct negotiations, as long as the negotiations guarantee secure borders to this tiny little state of Israel. And, you know, let's admit it, that bloody history, as Dr. Vincent just lately so nice, only points out that only a defensible Israel with secure borders guarantees a peaceful Middle East.
Okay, more or less.
You have 1 minute.
Okay. More or less, I would like just to add one point to the peace question that my wife gave up, presented here, the background to the state of Israel. And it's another point that really helped me, and it's blackmailing. You can blackmail money, you can blackmail many values today in the world. One thing you cannot do, you cannot blackmail peace or blackmail direct negotiations the way the Arab countries were trying to do it for the last 25 years. There were two countries that stood by this blackmailing, and the Netherlands and the United States. The United States has its own interests besides its right and humanitarian value. But the Netherlands, which is a poor country as it is, was not willing to sell this kind of ethic and value, honest value, that called righteousness, and they were not willing to sell it for the oil. All those countries, including the United States, somehow or another are affected by the oil poison. Let me just state one thing. Oil is one thing and fish is another thing. Fish cannot be blackmailed. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, the Arab side has 10 minutes rebuttal. I will allow you to introduce yourself, but we're not even into that time. Please go ahead.
My name is Ali Salam. I'm an Egyptian. I live in Cairo most of my life. My friend right here is a Palestinian. And Antonio is a Cuban-American who is living in this country for almost all his life now.
On their opening statement, they made, first of all, they spoke of the Nazi terrorism, which I think has had nothing to do with bringing peace to the Middle East today. I feel that that point was irrelevant. But since they wanted to bring this point up, we wanted to stress that at the same time that Americans wanted 100,000 Jews into Israel, right into Palestine, right away at the time, which is what President Truman was calling for, in the first 8 months of 1946, only 4,667 Jews were allowed into the United States. So what the United States in fact was trying to do was that they knew if these Jewish refugees would not go to Palestine, they would not go to any other country in the world but the United States. And 2 to 3 million Jews coming into the United States was something that some Senate representatives were objecting to. If I see some people in the crowd laughing, if you doubt what I say, this statement can be found in the book Genesis 1948. But I start to see the humor then. Now, another statement they pointed out was the fact that they said that Zionism didn't bring anything new to Palestine in the 1940s. The Haganah was organized, the Irgun, the Stern Gang. These were Jewish terrorist groups who massacred the Palestinians. The King David Hotel explosion on July 26, 1946, in which 100 Arab, British, and Jews were innocently killed by these terrorist groups. On blackmail or embargo of Arab oil, this is a good way for Israel to for these representatives to misuse the word blackmail. Embargo would be a more proper word. Arab solidarity has been proved by this oil embargo.
Ali? I would like to point the fact that 6 million Jews were persecuted in Europe by the Zionist terrorists. Why does this have to be an account of the Palestinians? He stated that none of the countries in the world accepted the Jews at that time, so he shipped them to the Arabs. The word blackmail that he used, as Tony said, the word is embargo. It sounds ridiculous for the Arabs to supply the United States with oil, to build factories and weapons, for later on to give it to Israel to kill ourselves. She mentioned the hatred against the Jews. Personally, as many Arabs would agree with me that I have no hate against the Jews. My whole objective is I'm against the political movement called Zionism. The Zionist is trying to make a homeland for all the Jews in the world, in Palestine, forgetting completely about the people who lived there before. And we will stress more in this point in our speech. Thank you.
You mentioned everything that I've mentioned, so I was going to go ahead.
I wanted to make another comment. They seem to be relying on old statements of about bringing peace in the Middle East. I mean, they quoted statements from 48, 56. I haven't heard any recent statements about what the Arab leaders are saying. Excuse me? Well, I'm going to read one for you. This is in Time magazine last week. It says, this is President Nasser speaking on Egypt's point. He says, Egypt will not settle for less. Excuse me, Sadat. First of all, we have to point out that Sadat is a nationalist, not a Nasserist. He stressed that Egypt will not settle for less than the return of all of its territories, but Sadat is willing to provide the kind of guarantees that Israel has long demanded. Free navigation in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aqaba, a non-revocable international force at Sharm el-Sheikh, and even Israeli purchase of Sinai oil. All are possible once Egyptian sovereignty over its Israeli-occupied territories is recognized. Now, we'd like to make our opening statement.
Mr. Chairman, member of the opposition, faculty, fellow students, and honored guests. In our proposition, we would like to stress that for the overwhelming majority of the American people, know the facts about the Middle East come from what they hear and read in the electronic news media and the major press in this country. For 25 years, the media has presented distorted facts regarding the Arabs and has glorified Israeli antics. Why have we taken that stand? The answer is very simple. Let us examine who controls the news media in this country. NBC TV and radio is controlled by Robert Sarnoff and Julian Goodman. NBC TV and radio is controlled by Leonard Goldson. William Haley controls CBS. The New York Times is regulated by Salzberger, Rosenberg, and Frankel. Larry Israel is president of Newsweek. Mrs. Graham is with the Washington Post, Channel 10 Miami, and WTOG Washington, D.C. What do all these people have in common? They are all Jewish and pro-Zionist. If you control the media, you control the minds of the people. And if you control the minds of the people, you control the nation. Major General Carl von Horn, Chief of Staff of the United Nations in Palestine, said in connection with the Israeli investigation, quote, "We were amazed at the iniquity of the falsehood, which distorted the true picture. The highly skilled Israeli Information Service and the entire press combined to manufacture a warped, distorted version, which was disseminated to every available channel to the people and the sympathizers in America and the rest of the world. Never in my life had I believed the truth could be so expertly bent." Unquote. As Arab American students for peace, we are really stressing that each individual has the right, if not the duty, to know the facts in order to judge whether the support of his government is extending to Israel is justifiable. The U.S. government has supported and still supports Israel because American politicians, from President Truman onward, considered or were made to believe that he needed the Jewish vote in order to ride or to ride back into power. And appealing to support the Zionist claim, they have been always, they have been the first settler in the land of Palestine, as he said. Our research contradicts the theory. As he said, look in the Bible, in the Old Testament, in chapter 3 in Deuteronomy. The Israelis described how they came to Palestine as the invaders. Quote, "And we took the cities at that time, utterly destroying men, women, and children. And we took all the land that was on this side of the Jordan, from River Arnon into Mount Hermon." Unquote. The Zionist belief for historic right to Palestine has no foundation, either in law or in fact. In law, the claim to a territory after 2,000 years under the pretext of historic right is ludicrous. In fact, during antiquity, the Philistines and the Canaanites and more than half a dozen other tribes dwelled there, from whom descended the Christians and the Muslims. In 1917, through the Balfour Declaration, Great Britain viewed with favor the establishment of in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, even though 90% of the population of Palestine was non-Jewish. The Balfour Declaration was described as a document in which one nation solemnly promised a second non-existing nation, a country of a third. This caused a flood of political-minded Jews to migrate to Palestine. For a decade before the State of Israel was formed, Zionists
Then it says that the Haggah, the Erdogan, and the Spain gang indiscriminately killed the Palestinians. The massacre of Palestinians by the Jewish terrorists occurred in towns like Yassin, Laida, Beersheba, and many others. On April 9, 1948, the village of Yassin on the outskirts of Jerusalem was attacked by the Spain gang. An account of this horrible deed was given by Jacques Grenier, the chief delegate of the International Red Cross who witnessed the tragedy. Quote, over 250 Arabs were massacred without any military reason or propagation of any kind. Men, women, children, and newly born were murdered with knives by Jewish troops who looted and raped, entirely under the control and direction of their chiefs. Unquote. Their objective was to terrify the Arab civilian population into fleeing. In towns like Ramallah, Haifa, Safar, the Zionists restored the outright expulsion of all Arabs. Let us not forget that these same Jews who committed these crimes were the same people who fled Nazi Germany. Before their independence, the Zionists were taking advantage of the superior military preparation and organization provided, of course, by Great Britain and the United States. Seeing over 20,000 square kilometers, almost 80% of the land of Palestine, it's not in contrast to the 6% land ownership they held at that time. The second objective was to free the territory of the proposed Jewish state from its Arab inhabitants, who, if allowed to remain, will constitute the majority of the population. In other words, the Zionists wanted the land without its people. This in Zionist creed was necessary in order to ensure the creation in Palestine of a state that would racially, religiously, and exclusively Jewish. In a state where nationality is based upon the Jewish religion, and the political structure is basically racist, what chance does a Christian or a Muslim have to live in peace and dignity? Arab reactions from other countries against Israel aggression came in form exponentially forces to protect the Palestinians. The British commander of the Arab region of Jordan during the Arab-Israeli War in 1948 gives the following figures about the Arab and Israeli armies. In his book, The Soldier with the Arab, quote, the total Arab forces which took the field on May 15, 1948 may be estimated as follows. Egypt constituted 10,000, the Arab Legion 4,000, Syria 3,000, Lebanon 1,000, Iraq 3,000, for a total of 21,000. Against the Jewish troops of 65,000, because everybody at that time was in the army. There was no joint Arab planning of any kind. No plan existed. Unquote. These forces were outnumbered and defeated through the superior technology of the Zionists, which we stated it was provided by Great Britain and the United States. The number of Palestinians displaced in 1948 was over 1,800,000. The tragedy of these people is that their country was given by a foreign power to another people for the creation of a new state. There are 1.5 million Palestinians displaced who live all around the borders of Israel. The Zionists have done nothing for these Palestinians. They would like to see them assimilated into Arab countries so that they will not have to pay any reparation or treat them as equal. Peace becomes hopeless when a leader like Golda Meir declares, quote, there is no such thing as Palestinians. They do not exist. And boasts that Israel will never allow an independent Palestinian nation on its plans. The Arabs have made several efforts toward peace. Egypt expelled 17,000 Russian advisors in an effort to gain an even-handed policy to the United States. Then, the National Security Advisor of Egypt went on a peace mission to Washington and other capitals in an effort to create a diplomatic deadlock. That didn't work either. Hardly had he left Washington when the United States announced it was supplying Israel with 48 more fighter jets. The Egyptians concluded they can count on nothing from Washington. Recently, the most unexpected display of realism came from the Palestinian leaders. Shafiq Houd, head of the Palestinian Liberation Organization in Lebanon, he stated that we are moving away from long-held demands for the restoration of Israel, Palestine. Quote, if we say no to peace negotiation, we have finished. We have turned out to be great martyrs and lousy politicians. Unquote. It is abundantly clear that the refugee has every right to the homeland from which they were driven. and the denial of these rights is the main contributing factor. No people anywhere in the world would accept being expelled in masses from their own country. How could anyone require the people of Palestine to accept a punishment which nobody would tolerate? No settlement in the Middle East problem can be realistically conceived unless it provides for the redress of the wrongs done to the Palestinians and unless it's worked out and formulated with them. The permanent just settlement of the refugee in the homeland is an essential ingredient of any genuine lasting peace in the Middle East. Thank you.
The Israeli side has 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, I would like to answer my friend here on the left. One very simple answer, the word Palestinian. Somehow we do not understand that I'm more Palestinian than any other sitting in Israel, since I'm the seventh generation in Jerusalem born, both sides. That means I'm Palestinian as anyone else. So I have my own fight against Palestinians, the way you explain it. Another thing, Palestinians in Israel, the land that was taken from them. Since 1917, Jewish money bought a lot of land in Israel. It was bought by the Kushan, which is the term used in the Ottoman system as some kind of official buying of land. 92% of the land that Israel holds or held at that time was bought on papers in the normal system. The fact that the Arab nation took it over, it was another reason for the war. Arabs were not sent away. In fact, we have 650,000, and I'm talking about 1948 to 1967. We had in the state of Israel 650,000 Arabs living with full civil rights equally to the Israeli citizen, Jewish Israeli citizen. In Israel we are Israelis, there are Jewish, Arabs, Muslims, Christians, whatever have you. I would like to answer one more thing about murder of civilians, the way it was said by the opposition here. Murder of civilians is, in a wartime, kind of normal thing. Let's look at all our wars in the world, and it happened. In a wartime, it happened. If some civilian leaves around any military target, they might suffer for that. And that's what happened in every war. Whether we like it, the Jewish people, in this last war, we saw it on our side and on their side. Whether you have civilians surrounded by military targets, the kind of war that the world is running this time, you cannot pick individuals. You pick an area and it's the consequences of a war. We are pity for that. We feel bad about it. And we have to apologize and compensate all those people that suffered from that. But the same way, we would like to be treated. It's not a one-way street. You cannot talk about one side with ignoring your side. It's, again, it's not a one-way street. Thank you.
I was a little bit struck by the opening statement, especially at the beginning of it, because my colleague said could perfectly be quoted from German newspapers in, I think, 1937-38. This reference to the Jewish who control the minds of people, who control the sources of wealth, was very useful to Hitler and to the Nazi Party at their beginnings. And I think that there has no place in our debate here. One thing I would like to say is that the name of this debate is Peace in the Middle East, and we should have been talking here about ways of doing peace, not about reasons for hatred and reasons for fight. Reasons for fight, there are enough. The problem is, how can we get peace in the Middle East? And there is one major question. This question is, there, since 1948, there exists a state called Israel. And since 1948, this state has been looking for peace, asking for peace. Not once or twice, Israeli leaders have stated that they were ready to meet with Arab leaders wherever they want, whenever they want, and talk. Talk about the refugees question, talk about borders, talk about anything, talk about peace. Those offers have been consistently rejected, and the answer to them have always been war. War in 1948, threats of war in 1956, war in 1956, I think. War, actual war in 1967, actual war again in Yom Kippur 1973. Of course, I think one thing has been proved now, that war will not solve the problems. And again, we have now the results of a new summit meeting of Arab leaders, and again they come out with statements of war. And this brings me to the point I want to make clear. It was that there is no such thing that an Arab point of view, an Arab point of view, one, there isn't. And that's the problem, because when President Bourguiba from Tunisia, many years ago, proposed to Arab countries to recognize, to publicly recognize the existence of Israel, he was not heard. There is too much of conflict between the Arab leaders themselves. At this summit meeting, at least three of the Arab leaders were absent, and one of them, King Hussein of Jordan, was absent for one reason, because there were representatives of the Palestinian, so-called Palestinian guerrilla movement. So even when Ali talks about the rights of the Palestinian people, the question arises, do the Arabs know what are the Palestinian people? Do they know what their rights are? Because King Hussein of Jordan thinks that the Palestinians are citizens of Jordan. As a matter of fact, when Israel was created and Palestine was divided, Israel remained in its place, but the other part of Palestine, which was supposed to be a Palestinian state, was taken over by Jordan and by Egypt. They were those who deprived their Palestinian fellow from their lands. The I'm sorry.
I just want to answer Mrs. Abizar, saying the Arabs are living much better under the Israeli occupation. This is the logic of colonialism throughout modern history, has been that the natives are living better under colonial rule than they were before the colonial came there. This argument has been rejected by mankind because there is a such thing as the right to self-determination, which is a fundamental of a human right. Must Zionists always place a monetary price on freedom and dignity?
Okay, I have a very good answer to you. If we look at the dictatorship in some of the Arab countries, you'll find out that the leaders do the opposite. They have to create the problem. If they'll give food and decent housing, decent life to those Palestinian refugees, they would solve the refugees' problems. Then they wouldn't have anything to do with Israel. Now, by raising those problems, by giving them and presenting the world with such a problem, you cannot do it. You must give them those concentration camps, what they call, they live like, excuse me, it's pig holes, those places that we were taking over in Gaza Strip. For 20 years those people lived like that. Come over and look at what Israel did in those, in this Gaza Strip and this refugees camp, and how well we've given human treatment to human people. We're trying to solve a problem, not to fix it.
Now, your statement as far as Israel regarding the Palestinians, Golda Meir has already said that there are no such thing as Palestinians. They do not exist. The Israeli Zionist belief is that if these people become Jordanians, become Syrians, become Lebanese, they've gotten themselves rid of the problem of Palestinians. For 25 years, they have been on the world's conscience. Israel has made no reparations for these people, yet Germany has paid $16 billion in reparations to Israel. After the Munich incident last year, they were awarded $1 million. Yet Israel still does not do anything for these people. If these people incorporate themselves into other countries, it would be a form of genocide. The Palestinians as a people would have vanished. There would be no more Palestinians. But the people tenaciously refuse to do this. They are a country, they have their own customs, they have their own rights. They should not dissolve themselves.
This comparison between Israel and German, and stating that Israel owes reparations because German pays reparations, is the most fallacious argument has ever been created. And it's an example of that kind of argument that say, repeat a lie until it is believed to be true truth. How can you compare what German did to Jewish people to what Israel did to any other people, or Palestinian or something like that? Those Palestinians fled from their fields, like Gila said, because they were told so by their own leaders. And furthermore, they have been fed with hatred for 20 years. How can you speak about any kind of reparations?
The reason they fled is not, when they say a town like there has seen about 300 people massacred and bought up and then they set them on fire. The only choice they have left is to leave the city. That the tools they use in order to terrify the other cities so they could leave.
Mr. Rosenthal, you've already compared us to Nazis because of our opening statement. I want to say that that quote came out of Anita Ephraim's book, The News Twisters, and all those facts came out of it. We are not, and we did not talk about any Jewish monetary value in this country. We only pointed out the fact that the majority of the news media in this country is owned by pro-Zionists.
Okay, I want to answer about the media, the news media that you mentioned now. First of all, maybe I should remind you that you're staying in a free country, in a democratic country called the United States, if you didn't know that. Now, this is no issue. The fact that you own a television channel or broadcasting service makes you an owner of this broadcasting service. You cannot, in a free country, a democratic country, use it as a tool. Let me remind you again the difference between Cuba and the United States, for example, or between Egypt and Islam. A democratic country would not allow this kind of corruption. How can you just say such a thing?
You call Israel as a democratic country. Let me remind you that Israel is more of a theocracy. And theocracy is a country ruled by a religion rather than a democracy. Regardless of whether or not he is believed in a matter of birth, marriage or death, or divorce. An Israel citizen is totally subject to the rulings of rabbinical court. And let me remind you that Israel doesn't have a written constitution
or a bill of rights.
Okay,
let me just ask you one thing. What do you think, the 16 representatives of the Arab countries who are not, of the Arab refugees, who are not Jews, they are Muslims, whether you like it or not. They are Muslims and they are Christians, who represent their parties in the State of Israel Parliament. How could you call Israel a theocratic country? They are members in the Parliament, they take part in the Labour Party, they vote. How could you say such a thing?
Can I just one more thing? Everything that you just said is a quote from the book. You've never been to Israel and you've never lived there. So wait a minute. So when you quote from the book, just a second.
These are written statements to your answers that we have presumed that at the time you were going to ask.
Yes.
What is it again?
No.
Well, anyway.
I am a Palestinian. I lived most of my life in the West Bank of Jordan.
So
don't say I don't know about nothing about the situation over there. I know I've seen things happening.
You live in Jordan?
I live in Ramallah, which is about 10 miles from Jerusalem. And I've seen the Israelis, what they've done in 1967. After the war in 1967, I went to the East Bank of Jordan to visit my uncle. I couldn't come back. When I tried to cross the river, I seen 18 people got killed by the Israeli hands when they tried to cross the Jordan River so they could go back to their own homeland.
Okay, I apologize for that to my colleagues on the left hand side. I think this is getting to be a very personal thing here, and we should drop it at that point.
A point that we want to make is that if you have studied your history, you will know that the Arabs and the Jews have lived together in peace for thousands of years. It has not been until Zionism came that, until the Zionism came into the Middle East, that there has been a conflict between the Arabs and the Jews. As you know, in Spain, when the Arabs took over Spain, the Jews had the height of their history. Their golden period was in Spain because the Arabs helped them and let them settle there.
So the audience will have a chance to participate in 10 minutes. So if you could hold off until then, you'll have that right. Sure, right to speak now.
I want only to ask one question. Of course, I don't expect you to present the Arab point of view, but because, as I said, I don't believe there is any. But there is one. Not that there is any. There is one. But your own point of view. Do you think that the State of Israel has a right to exist among all the three peoples?
Yes. 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 Definitely, I say yes.
Where?
What do you mean where?
Where can they exist if not in their own land?
Not themselves. The Israelis, the Jews, I mean, the Arabs and the Christians live in this land of Israel, as so-called Israel now, in peace and dignity.
They do?
Let me remind you, the conflict consists of two parts. The conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and the conflict between the Arab nations and Israel. We have stated the fact that a reparation for the Palestinians is a very essential ingredient for that peace. By finding wars and winning them, Israel has achieved nothing towards peace the way she seeks, rather than she has moved one hostile border from one place to another, possibly more hostile than before. By winning four wars, this will gain the Israeli nothing. It will cause the Arab people to be more hostile, more aggravated to get the land back.
Let me answer this lovely statement. From one border to another border and build more hostile. It's amazing how people can talk like that. Well, you know that we started this war 2 days after the Arabs. I'm talking about the last war. This war was in close on us, and the world knows that, and the Arab knows it better than everybody else. And caught us in a very bad situation on the highest holiday that the Jewish faith has, and it's Yom Kippur. Very nice strategic and good tactics. But on the other hand, this war was something that we could not expect from any war. And it's the basic negotiations that we have now with the Egyptians.
Let me ask you.
Now, we are not trying to expand. Believe me, we are not trying to expand. The state of Israel was willing, even 2 years ago, to give up the whole Sinai Peninsula. It was willing to give up a portion of the Golan Heights, willing to give up the Eastern Bank, the Western Bank, excuse me, and in order to get one simple thing that every country in the world has, and it's peaceful kind of living. We want peace. This peace, we tried it, and believe us that we tried it. We tried in 1948, and we tried in 1956, and we tried in 1967. But this peace cannot be done by a telephone call.
Why
we have to sit and talk about it. Now let's see what the Arab nation was willing to do, especially after this conference in Algiers that ended yesterday with a lovely statement that there won't be a peace till Israel will withdraw. How could you talk to people by saying, until you go back, they're not going to sit and talk to you? Why should I go back after I learned that in 1948 I went back and did not get it, 56, 67, and so forth?
You say that Israel seeks peaceful boundaries. Well, what they have now is a zigzag frontier all along the Sinai. I don't see how they're going to, achieve any kind of buffer zone or anything like that. Now, when Israel occupied the Sinai in 1967 war, she was able to take control of 117 Egyptian oil wells. These oil wells have produced for Israel $80 million in income per year. This is one of the reasons why Israel has opted for territorial annexation rather than for peace. 80% of her oil comes from the Sinai. Now, answer me, how can a nation that exports citrus fruits make up $80 million in income per year? This is why they refuse to get back to Sinai.
Let me just answer one thing about holding or occupying areas, whatever you're trying to call it. Let's look at the history of the world. World War I, World War II. There isn't even one country in Europe that was involved in the Second World War that did not change its border because of the war. The world accepted it as a matter of fact. The moment the state of Israel trying to protect its own land, or to get a better border, or to get something to negotiate with, they're not willing to talk with us if we wouldn't have it.
You talk about a better border. Israel starts as a very small state, or a tiny state, as she said. Then they do a milk kibbutz, farmland, agriculture, they put settlers there, people go there. They suddenly realize it's 10 miles away the borders. We need a buffer zone. You get the war, they win it, you get the buffer zone. He sets up the land, build the land again, settlers, agriculture land, and expansion they need for all the Jews immigrating to Israel.
What you're saying is that Israel is using the war and territorial expansion so that the people who live in the agricultural settlements could live peacefully.
Yes.
But on the other hand, any territory also means new settlements. Now, I couldn't... Okay, let me just say something about the Golan Heights, which is up in Syria. We needed the Golan Heights because the Golan Heights is a plateau overlooking Israeli settlements. And if you ever go there, you realize that when you stand up there as a Syrian soldier, you see every person, and this went on for 19 years, you see every person leaving his home, going to eat, going to the field. It is the best overlooking point that ever existed in this particular area of the Middle East. Now, not only that, but the Syrians built on top of that plateau positions, strongholds, in the mountains with cannons. Now tell me, can you live for 19 years with a cannon right above your head, with a sword hanging right above your head, and then say, gee, I live peacefully, you know? Now not only that, but those cannons can shoot, and they do. They did. Okay? All through the years. So this is what I call self-defense, and this is what we call secure borders.
When they stand and shoot, when the Syrians start shooting at the Israelis, when they start using it against the Israelis, they never used against the Israelis. They never used against the Israelis, but they were used for the protection of the Syrian war and the Golan Heights, because also the Israelis had a superiority in the air. Therefore, they only should have
Now, Israel has been condemned by the United Nations Security Council over 40 times for placing raids upon the other Arab countries. In April 10, 1973, they went into Beirut, Lebanon, and killed three Palestinian leaders in their bed while they slept, and one was with his wife. She was also murdered. You mean to tell me this is a defensive attitude?
Yeah, I better. Otherwise, I wouldn't survive it. Let me tell you. There are a few sides. And in the outside, there are at least 10 sides. One of the sides that it's very hard to negotiate with are the Palestinian guerrillas. Those terrorists never accepted ceasefire. For them, it's a wartime since they created themselves. There are many of them, and they're doing very well. The world knows, just yesterday, they gave release to the Dutch airliner. On purpose, I did not bring this up, and I was waiting for you to bring it. It's a shame that you can sit here and talk about terrorism, and the act against terror was against the terrorists.
Okay,
and I want to tell you that it wasn't just against the Jews, it was against any country that supports the idea of a Jewish country.
Okay,
by prior agreement, both sides have indicated that the last 15 minutes will be devoted to open discussion from the floor. Now, to prevent this from disintegrating into a Middle East war, I suggest that the person that wants to speak, raise their hand, I'll recognize them, and they address their question to one side or the other, which will then answer. Yes. Could you please indicate who you are before you address?
I'm Gertrude Teddy, and I live at Kings Point in Delray.
Thank you.
I'd like to direct my question to the chap from Egypt. He is an Arab. I am a Jewess. I'm not a practicing Jewess, but I speak only for decency. Now, he says that all of the people of the airwaves are Jewish. The New York Times is Jewish, which is absolutely absurd, because they are corporations, and they do not put down the policy in all things, because you do have stockholders who then can dictate the policy at their stockholder meeting. And as for what this other chap from Cuba, who no doubt is sympathetic to dear Castro,
you're wrong, man. Let me correct you. I fight oppression.
I think there's an understanding. Could I interrupt for a moment? The
idea, reading
things
from a book definitely pro-Arab. He is not reading anything which is neutral
to
the thing.
But we have agreed.
That is a pro-Arab book.
That is written by a Jew.
That doesn't make any difference. There are Jews who are pro-Arab.
We've agreed that the audience will be allowed to ask questions of either side, but not make statements. So could you ask your question, please?
Well, just as this boy from Israel, from Egypt, is sympathetic to the Palestinian people and he's right to be, so that the Jews in other parts of the world are sympathetic to Israel and they have a right to be.
Thank you. May I remind you again that the purpose of the audience participation is to ask questions of the panel. Back there, please.
My name is Simeon Ugu, and I'm a student at SAU here. I want to ask a question to the two sides. Yes, like one side will answer, and then the other side will give an answer.
That's acceptable.
Okay. My question is, after the First World War, you know, a promise was given to both the Palestinian Arabs and the Jews in Palestine by the British that they were going to have their individual states. Unfortunately, after the 1945, the Jewish state was created. Then a certain part of that Palestine was annexed by Jordan, the other part was annexed by Egypt. And my question is, does the two sides think that if Jordan returns that part they are next, and Egypt returns that part they are next, and then Israel returns the part they seized in 67, and that will bring a solution to the problem in the Middle East.
Okay. Now on this, I'll have to limit your answer to 1 minute each so that we can get as many questions answered as possible.
He was talking about the annexation of Jordan of the small part that was left off Palestine. Now this is only 20%. Under the United Nations partition, Palestine was partitioned into two. Before their independence, Israel occupied and took over 80% of the part that was to have gone to Palestine. Therefore, it left the Palestinians with only 20%. They refused to accept this as a nation, and they held out for waiting to get a bigger partition from Israel and from the United Nations.
Let me answer you very shortly. Territories, generally speaking, are good for the bargaining of any peace settlement. And you've seen this in Europe all through the years, and you've seen it in the Far East. But as far as Israel, with all her Arab neighbors, maybe there would have been a settlement, but when this just very recent summit Arab conference comes up with a statement there will never be any negotiation, there will never be any peace, then I don't see how any small bargaining of that territory or the other territory can count altogether if the major principle is no, big N-O.
Yes, thank you. Yes.
In history here. Perhaps you don't know your history as well as you should. When you said that the Arabs and the Jewish people lived together with no peace, with peace until the state of Israel, how can you forget the Arab conquests of the Middle East, what happened to the few Jews left living there after the Roman diaspora, and what about the Crusades? You're deliberately alienating American Christians toward anti-Semitism.
Ma'am, what I said was, and I highly stress that, the Jewish golden period, which happened in Spain from the year 763 A.D. in cities like Toledo until 1492, happened because the Arabs let them stay in Spain, and because they lived in peace, I should say the Moors let them stay there, and they lived in peace.
Anti-Semitism. May I remind you that Arabs also are Semitic. We cannot say that Americans are going to hate the Arabs too. I am a Semitic myself.
Dr. Kingston, can I answer to that? I wish to answer to that statement. Let me just answer to that statement of Arabs being Semites as well. If the Arabs couldn't be anti-Semites because they are Semites, how is it that Arabic propaganda, and you know it better than I do, uses Nazi cartoons from World War II, the major sign that the Syrian soldiers had up in the Golan Heights at 67 that they had on the pamphlet was a Jew within the Magenta Bridge being strangled by all the Arab nations, okay? So if this is not anti-Semitism, I don't think I know what anti-Semitism is.
I don't think so. Would you ask your question? Say who you are and answer the question.
My name is Brian Steinberg. I go to this college. I'm breaking the trend here a little bit. I just would like to know your reasons for the oil embargo.
You're asking the Arab?
The Arab, yes.
I think I have just stated that we cannot supply the United States with oil, or again to supply Israel with arms to kill ourselves. I mean, we are supplying Israel with oil to build factories, to build weapons, tanks, phantoms. 2 weeks later, the phantoms are bombing Cairo.
What about the rest of the world?
About what?
The rest of the world, like Japan, and even belts supply arms?
Well, we put the whole embargo on all Arab countries because it is the only way that the whole world will take the Arab cities. It is the only way. You look at the news, oh, the Arabs are the easy party. God damn, what's the Dolphins doing to this? You don't care about the Arabs and the Israelis. When you start saying a dollar a gallon, you say, what the hell are you supposed to, why is this happening?
You start taking more interest in the situation over there. Okay, you have the right of one question. And we have another person, please. Thank you.
My name is Hussein Matari. I'm going to Bombay Junior College. How the peace could be settled in spite of I am a Palestinian who has kicked from his home when he had born, and my parents lived for several generations there, and Golda Meir from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, governed that governor that state. I'd like you to answer this question, please. How is Golda Meir? She born and raised in the United States, Wisconsin, and she governed the state of Israel, and I'm a Palestinian, has kicked twice from my homeland. How the peace could be worse in that area?
Okay, let me just say one thing. You said I was kicked out. I'm sorry to tell you, but I don't believe you. I want to tell you that the fact that we have 650,000 Arabs living in this country, they were not kicked out.
How about the other 2 million?
Why? Because they were not convinced to leave this country. They wanted to stay because they thought that there is some future to that. The fact that your family left, it was up to them. Again, the fact that you brought that our prime minister was born and raised in Milwaukee, that's the greatness of democracy. The fact that the state of Israel, the fact that the state of Israel is welcoming every Jew to live there and to participate as well as the Arabs. And don't wonder, I promise you, that you'll see that we have some mayors of big cities coming in the next election.
I'd like to ask the Arabs a question. Could you explain to me how it's possible for the Arabs, for all these 20 years that your refugees have been in your borders, were never absorbed by the millions of Arab countries, millions of Arab people, and the countries who have enough countries to disseminate all of these and absorb them? Every Jewish refugee was absorbed by Israel. You never took care of your own, and I'd like to know why or how.
I want to stress, you are overlooking one point. You are calling the Palestinians as Arabs. This would be as ridiculous as to say if there is a civil war in Argentina, which is a country in South America and speaks Spanish, that therefore Bolivia or Chile should take them in. The people have a tradition of their own. They have a culture of their own and a heritage of their own. To just simply assimilate these people into other Arab countries would destroy the Palestinians. They wouldn't exist anymore, which is what the Israelis want. There would be no more. This is genocide. Then you are advocating genocide.
Yeah.
I'd like to address the Israeli side, and it's under fight fire with fire. It seems taking these commando raids in other countries and hijacking planes like they did with the, I believe it was the Iraqi or Iranian airline, that is hijacking, how can you, it seems like they're condoning terrorist methods if you use them. And I can't understand myself how a government can stand behind that, say, we approve of these terrorist activities, you know, we're going to fight you with terrorism, in fact, you know, you're submitting to them. I don't agree with terrorism myself.
Okay, and I think Mr. Arts has tried to explain this before, that these acts were done against the acts of the Arab guerrilla movement. Now, the Arab, the point of war against terrorism is ruled out as of now, it's invalid. I'm not willing to go into the to list down now all the acts that the Arab guerrillas took, but as far as hijacking planes, let me remind you the massacre in the Lod Airport.
I'd like to address the Israeli side, and it's under fight fire with fire. It seems making these commando raids in other countries and hijacking planes like they did with the, I believe it was the Iraqi or Iranian airline, that is hijacking, how can you, it seems like you're condoning terrorist methods if you use them. And I can't see, I can't understand myself how a government can stand behind that, say, we approve of these terrorist activities, you know, we're going to fight you with terrorism, you know, you're submitting to them. I don't agree with terrorism myself.
Okay, and I think Mr. Arts has tried to explain this before, that these acts were done against the acts of the Arab guerrilla movement. Now, the Arab, the point of war against terrorism is ruled out as of now, it's invalid. I'm not going to go into the to list down all the acts that the Arab guerrillas took, but as far as hijacking claims, let me remind you the massacre in the Lod airport where Puerto Rican pilgrims were killed, not even Jews, and by Japanese who were supporting the Arab guerrillas. Let me remind you of the TWA airplane that was bombed, of AI plane that was hijacked, of TWA that was bombed in the air behind Switzerland. So all these acts were taken by the Arab terrorists against Israel. So I don't see any reason why Israel shouldn't hit the Arab guerrillas where they are. And let me tell you the three King Hussein of Jordan on that matter, and you see who he supports in that matter, and why the Arab guerrillas had to fled away from Jordan and to go to Lebanon, and even there, they're restricted to South Lebanon.
Next question.
I have another question on the oil embargo. You said the only reason that the Arab world has done that is so that the rest of the world will look at them and take them seriously. But there's also been a statement that until the country espouses the view and all the demands of the Arabs, they will not get any oil. Now, certainly a country like Holland is not militarily, economically, or strategically involved in the actual either military or negotiations within the Middle East. But yet the Arab world has refused to allow any oil because they have stood up and said, this is wrong. This is genocide, not what you claim. So no oil is getting to them at all, mainly because they've stood up for humanity. Now, the Arab world has said, no oil unless you spout our demands. This isn't taking the world seriously. This is not allowing any freedom of a nation to make the decision as to which argument they want to accept. Now, is this because you're so afraid, if rationally the decision is made, that your side would not be supported when someone examines the argument?
No, the demands that they have asked for are the restoration of the Palestinians, which is quite humane.
These countries are, as you know, part of the NATO alliance, which the United States...
What about Japan?
The United States uses. Now, as you know, Germany was being used to ship arms from the United States to Germany to send them to Israel. These countries were used as depots and as stops on the way to supply Israel.
To the Arab countries and the United States ship to Israel. That seems only fair. But we want them to fight with spears and you with jets. Maybe then.
Our entire agreement, there is a time limit on this free debate now. After this last question, and this will be the last question.
It looks like to be more tough. I would like to just ask my question that you're debating the privilege to do it. This is, I guess, a question of, I'm concerned as to why, when Arabs and Israelis come together to talk about the problem of peace in the Middle East, they talk about the old civilizations, the bones, and the rest of it, without talking about the major question, and that is the idea that they both are Semitic peoples, that they are being manipulated by the superpowers, e.g. the United States and Russia, and that they do not sit down and solve their own problems so that they could use the oranges or the oil to the benefit of themselves rather than to the benefit of the superpowers. And I wonder when we're going to get that kind of communication.
This is
from
the Smith
Administration.
I'm allowed each side to make a brief statement on that comment, and then there'll be one more question. If you want to continue this further, it will not be under the formal constraints here. In other words, feel free to come up and talk to people on the panel, but I have to make a meeting elsewhere. Okay, last question.
Thank you. I know Antonio is a good friend of mine, but I have to disagree completely to his side. I have my reasons. I want to ask the question. I want to state the fact that most of the Jewish community do favor Israel for a reason for others, and I can prove that. And the question is how can, if Israel, like, as much as I read, they're willing to sit down. I'm not saying they're willing to give up the land, at least they're willing to sit down and talk peace. And how can, if they're willing to sit down, you come in 1973,
And like you said, in such a moment, that's like if somebody attacked us on Christmas Day, go ahead and launch an attack. I just don't see it. Why? What was the reason?
Well, first of all, to your question as to, you know, my being a Cuban, I am a Cuban refugee. I still hold my refugee status. I joined this group because I believe in the fight against oppression for the same reason that I belong to other Cuban groups in, that are fighting against oppression.
I believe that if the Cubans are supporting Israel, because they're not a state government is supporting Israel.
Which is a good part. They want to be American.
I want to be part of America, but I simply have to make another commitment. Is there anyone in the audience who would be prepared to handle the moderation role for me? I simply must go. And if you want to continue this today, you would be, sir? Well, perhaps possibly. I wish I could say I enjoyed it, but sure I can't. But I do want to thank the participants. I'm sorry we didn't make more progress in the direction of what you might call pacifistic solutions to these important problems. And I want to thank the gentleman for taking over my role.
My name is Jean-Marc Amel. I'm from Montreal, Canada. And I'll just hold on a dispute this time. I hold more or less the standpoint that these are two very religious nations, and it seems to me that the talk of God has been totally alienated, so I stand within this realm. Go ahead, the questions can continue.
All right, my name is Warren Samet, and I'm a student here. I think essential to this issue of why the nations, the Arab nations and Israelis, come to them and solve problems between themselves, is the question of whether the Arab nations really truly do acknowledge the right of Israel to exist. And the Arab side stated that you believe that the Arabs do acknowledge the right of Israel to exist. And you may be right. I'm wondering, I've heard the Arabs come out recently, and the reason for the recent war was to roll back borders to the 1967 original borders. Now, if that's true, Israel existed before 1967, so that seems to be a tacit admission that Israel has the right to exist. But then my question is, why was the 1967 war fought?
The news media handled the coverage of that war very badly. Let me explain to you the facts that led up to the war. The war started when, in Syria, a kibbutz was farming, and they rolled back the fence that was to have been in the buffer zone, no man's land. When they started to farm on this no man's land, Syrian farmers took shots at these people to roll them back. What ensued was Israeli retaliation upon Syria with jets, tanks, etc. Then Nasser said, warned Israel to lay off Syria, and because strategic arms were being shipped through the Gulf of Aqaba, he closed off the Straits of Tehran, which on the Sinai Peninsula and the two islands that are in the middle do make Egyptian waters. These are not international waters at the tip. When he did this, Israel called this an act of war. And this is when they rolled into Egypt, they shot down their air force, they shot down the Jordanian air force on the ground, and simply just rolled into the country.
Well, I may be mistaken.
Can I get back to the subject?
Yes.
I thought that if we came here to discuss some kind of a new approach to see what the success of going to achieve in the Middle East, and what I hear is always people pouring oil into a fire. This fire has been burnt for 25 years, and let's say that it's part of history, and then look at a better future. I'm sure that it's possible to get together. The fact that we're dealing with, unfortunately, we have bad enemies, and can't we just take the example of whatever went on in the last 2 weeks and on the kilometer 101 and between Suez and Cairo, which represents, actually it's not much, but it represents something. It's the first time in 25 years that those one side on the Israeli side and this time it's the Egyptians are sitting and somehow talking about, let's say, sense in the trend of peace that might bring to some kind of peace or some kind of settlement. What Israel is trying to do is just asking for a guaranteed peace. And a guaranteed peace means only the four big nations or the two big powers in the world sitting down and guaranteeing this peace. So there's no way this thing could exist anymore. And
let me suggest something for peace. A proposal. If the Arab nation admits that there is a state of Israel, and the state of Israel makes preparation for the Palestinians and get out of the Sinai Peninsula, the Golan Heights, and the Jordanian part, would this be a good peace settlement in your opinion?
Good morning. The state of Israel, they offered this 2 years ago.
And
in order to sit down together, the answer was no. First, you withdraw from all occupied areas. Then we'll discuss it. We did it in 1956, it didn't work. We opened in another war.
Okay, we're going to keep the discussion from the audience. Any questions related to these?
I would like to add that a note on a historical perspective. Recently, Egypt recognized the United States diplomatically again. And you stated earlier that that anyone, any nation, would protest if its people were expelled and its land were usurped unjustly. Well, it seems to me that the United States over 200 years ago and Europeans took over this land just that same way. And now, after 100 years, over almost 100 years of the bloodletting has stopped, well, my question is, how long, how much blood has to be shed, how long, how much time has to pass before the recognition that one people occupying the land deserves to be there? It seems also that to recognize the United States recognizes this historical precedent that one people does have, eventually have the right to live in a land in peace.
As you know, after all wars, there have been reparations made for the losing side. We fought Germany, defeated them. We have rebuilt their country and their economy. We did the same thing for Japan. Nothing has been done for the Palestinians. Golda Meir has made a statement that she will never allow an independent Palestinian nation on Israel's flank. She has also made a statement that there are no such thing as Palestinians and they do not exist. How can you begin to talk of peace?